This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at wil.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, this afternoon, I welcome your questions for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. And here we are on the first Monday of the month of October. If you have questions about diet and nutrition, give us a call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She specializes in developing personalized nutrition plans for athletes and the general public. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find her on the web at www.nutritiononthemove.net. Questions about diet and nutrition are invited this afternoon. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
How are you?
Doing fine. It's actually cool out there right now.
It's nice, isn't it?
It is.
Nice.
It
well,
is.
I feel great. I've had 2 weeks off.
Just feel
so renewed.
Yes.
You know, and one of the things we're going to talk about this afternoon, you suggested high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And that vacation just took care of that problem for me.
Bet.
But anyway, what would you like to say in terms of high blood pressure and diet?
Well, one of the reasons I thought it'd be good to talk about this is because I have had a lot of clients lately who've come in with high blood pressure, and just like high cholesterol, I think we're realizing that if there are some things you can do with your diet and with exercise and maybe managing your weight a little bit better, that hopefully, for some people at least, we can prevent going on medications. Or even if you go on medication for high blood pressure, maybe you don't have to take as much if you're doing some other things diet-wise as well. So what I wanted to talk about was the DASH diet. And the DASH diet is the diet, it's called DASH because it's considered Dietary Approaches to Stopping Hypertension. And about 10 years ago, not quite, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, some research was started and that actually looked at, well, what kind of diet would people be on if they combined certain things, maybe to help them decrease blood pressure. And the diet was actually based on a relatively low-sodium diet. Actually, there have been some studies on 1,500 milligrams, which is kind of our general recommendation for health right now, and also 2,300 or 2,400 milligrams, which is more the national recommendation that it's been for a period of time. And in addition to that, the diet is high in fiber. It's relatively low in fat. It's high in calcium, high in potassium, which we know has a role in blood pressure regulation, and moderate in protein. And what we found from these combinations of foods, and we can talk more about what's actually in the diet as well, is that people tended to lose or decrease their blood pressure, whether or not they lost weight. For some people, they lost weight as well. And we do know that typically if people are overweight, even if they lose 3, 4, 5 pounds, for most people, that's going to drop their blood pressure. So, you know, even a small amount of weight loss affects blood pressure as well. But the whole idea is trying to get back to really balanced eating and then being really careful about the sodium that is added. But in addition, things like getting enough calcium, which we typically don't think of to lower blood pressure, but we know that that plays a role. We also know that if you get generally more potassium in your food, particularly more fruits and vegetables, and lower your sodium, then that tends to, for a lot of people, affect blood pressure as well. And so with these studies, we kind of find, well, with lifestyle management as well as just trying to put all these nutrients together, for many people, they've been able to decrease blood pressure, and particularly when it's been rather high. And so I think there are a lot of things we can do. I did bring a handout that we can have available for listeners on the DASH diet. It talks about different food groups, how much you'd really want to try to get in a day, what the serving sizes look like, and then different nutrients that you'd get in those foods, and also a couple of websites that actually have the National Heart, Blood, Lung Institute, which is one of the websites here, has a whole series of information on the DASH diet, and they have about a 68-page manual that you can print off And it's got everything from recipes to how to put the diet together to some background on the research. It's free of charge. And it's just a great resource if someone's saying, gosh, you know, my blood pressure is a little high. Maybe I should do something about it.
What's the role of fiber in lowering high blood pressure?
Well, there's some thought that, of course, if we eat more fiber, that may be related to the fact that you don't eat as many calories, which could still, you know, affect blood pressure in a way if weight management's an issue. But also with fiber, you know, if you get foods with a lot of fiber, they also tend to be high in other nutrients. So it may be the case, for example, if you have whole grain breads or whole grains in general, then you're also getting a lot more B vitamins, which may also play a role. I think the thing with blood pressure we're finding is that it's probably not just one thing. In other words, mm-hmm. It's not just drop your salt. For some people, that will really make a difference. For others, they may not be as sensitive to sodium, but it probably a combination of maybe more B vitamins, more fiber, more, again, calcium, more potassium, some of these natural nutrients that you're going to be finding in different foods. And the gist of the diet really says, well, let's get back to saying, for example, the servings of fruits and vegetables for this diet, it's 8 to 10 a day. So again, it gets all the way back to the fact, eat more produce, does a lot of wonderful things for the body, but 8 to 10 servings, when you're saying a serving is at least a half a cup or so, means that yes, we do want to try to get back to saying you're going to get 4 or 5 cups of fruits and vegetables a day, and just by doing that, you bump your fiber way up. So it ends up being a high-fiber diet naturally because of that.
Okay. We've got a listener who would like to talk with you, so let's go and take this call. A listener in Paris on line one. Hi.
Hi there. I'd like to change the subject, if I may.
Sure.
This is a very interesting subject that you're on. Osteoporosis is a big problem for all of us, and I wonder what foods would inhibit the assimilation of calcium. Is there something that we could not eat, that would help calcium assimilation so that bones could get heavier? Or improve, or whatever.
Right. Well, you bring up a really good point, because we often think, yes, let's try to get more calcium in the diet, make sure we get that in the diet. And I've even noticed a lot of multivitamins and multiminerals add more calcium now. But one of the things that is a concern with me is just what you talked about, because we do know that some other minerals, if you take them in with calcium, they tend to decrease, it makes the calcium not be absorbed as well. So, for example, iron is one of the things that you're talking about. If you take in a lot of iron with calcium, iron and calcium compete absorption in the body. And so
that's interesting.
Right. That is certainly one factor. And certain fibers, for example, may decrease calcium absorption if you take in a lot of, we just talked about fiber, but additional fiber. We know that if you take in calcium but you don't have much vitamin D, then you probably don't absorb it as well either. So there are all those factors. The other thing with calcium is the fact that sometimes I'll have clients who come in and they're taking maybe 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day, but they take it all at once. And we do know that you absorb it better if you break it down during the day. So, for example, too much calcium at one time is not as beneficial as having calcium throughout the day. So if you're going to take a 500 or 600 milligram calcium supplement with vitamin D, hopefully maybe also with magnesium and vitamin K, because they all aid in calcium absorption, then you would take that twice a day and not at the same time. And if you take a multivitamin with iron, if you need the iron, then you don't want to take that with calcium. You want to divide those out so you take them at separate times.
Now, you mentioned fiber. You mean some fibers are not good?
Well, fiber is good in general, but sometimes if you take a whole lot, for example, if you would take a fiber supplement, let's say you take something with maybe 10 grams of fiber or really, really high fiber cereal, then some of the minerals, might be calcium, might be iron, they may not get absorbed as well because of the fibers. They might bind with some of the absorption. So, you do want to kind of think that you're not going too crazy about any one thing when you're trying to take something else, you're trying to get these. And that's why
we're taking. But if the fiber is in the food, like even carrots and things like that, that wouldn't be too much.
No, that's not as big of a problem. It's actually, we find that more, here's an example with iron. Of course, this is a bit different from calcium, but with iron, if you're thinking, gosh, I'm a vegetarian and I'm going to be eating all these green vegetables, let's say I'm going to get a lot of broccoli and a lot of spinach, and I'm thinking, well, I'm going to get my iron that way. Well, there's a lot of the phytates in there, and there's a lot of the fibers in there that might decrease absorption of the iron. Even if it's in the food, you may not get all out of it. So that can be a case too. But the one thing I'd say with calcium is to make sure you're spreading it out during the day, that it's something hopefully with vitamin D at the least. And, you know, if you have vitamin D, if you have milk, for example, you're going to have vitamin D in that, and a lot of, and yogurt and other high calcium foods. So you try to break those down and have them throughout the day, and we think that they're better absorbed. So that's probably the main thing to keep in mind.
And, you know, there's something that I've found, and I'm going to use the brand name. I don't have any interest in the company or anything like that, but a glass of milk in the evening with Ovaltine in it.
What was that again?
Ovaltine.
Ovaltine.
Yeah, Ovaltine.
I love Ovaltine.
Yeah, well, look at the label. It's loaded with
kinds.
Stuff.
There's one that has chocolate in it, and there's one without the chocolate. Does chocolate inhibit calcium?
Well, chocolate can inhibit calcium a little bit, but I wouldn't worry about that. I mean, I get that question from parents all the time. Well, if I add a little chocolate to my kids' milk, they'll drink more of it. And I say, do it, because if you take in more, you're certainly, even if calcium inhibits it a little bit, you're still going to get more calcium in by drinking it. So I wouldn't worry if you had a little Ovaltine or if you had a little chocolate in there. And like you say, Celeste, a lot of those products that are maybe the powdered mixes that you'd add to milk are also fortified with calcium. So you get it not only from the milk.
And you get your D.
And you get your D from what you add in it. So that's another great idea.
Mm. But chocolate is one of the inhibitors, though, too. You shouldn't be eating a lot of chocolate bars, right?
Right.
Which I dearly love.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly, if you have a reasonable amount, I always think, well, what's a reasonable amount of chocolate? Probably maybe 3 kisses, something about that size. That might not sound that appetizing, but I mean, it's, you know, that probably is not an amount that I'd ever worry about. But yes, if you eat a big Hershey's bar and you're having that with your milk all the time, well, you probably are inhibiting some of that absorption.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
Okay. And all things moderation.
It's been so helpful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you
very
for calling.
Welcome. Let's talk with another listener now. Caller in Champaign, line 2. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. I am on a low potassium diet. And I was just double-checking. I have a list here of foods to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
Baked potato, baked winter squash, your basic legumes, canned tomatoes. And I was wondering, you know, just because it's a potato, I've been avoiding all potatoes for a month. And I was wondering, it says baked potato on my list. Is there a difference between the baked product and, say, the French fry when it comes to potassium? And also, I have given up my fresh spinach. Can I still eat some steamed spinach and maintain the low potassium diet, or are all these foods just forbidden?
Well, let me answer the potato question first. Potassium is in potatoes no matter what form as they are.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. So the good thing about fries is you can enjoy a few fries, and you're not going to get that much potassium if you have, let's say, half of a small order of fries.
Okay.
It's not going to be that much. And I've got a list of potassium here, because since we were talking about blood pressure, more potassium is good with blood pressure. But in your case, needing to watch it, you know, a medium potato has almost 1,000 milligrams of potassium. So that's a lot.
Right.
That's very high. But if you know, even a sweet potato, for example, has half that much. It's still high. It's about 500 milligrams, but it's considerably lower. So that's one option. And then also thinking about the amount that you have. Now, with spinach, too, you know, about a half cup cooked spinach has about almost 300 milligrams of potassium. But I would say if you like spinach, I would just use a little bit of fresh spinach.
Okay.
Because, you know, you've got more when it's cooked down. And I would just not have, you know, if you had a salad, throw in a little spinach, but maybe have it a little bit not as dark greens for most of it. And then you still get a lot of benefit from spinach, even though the total amount of potassium is not going to be nearly as high if you don't use a whole lot of it.
Okay.
So that would be, you know, one thing to think about, too. And like you say, the beans and legumes are very high. And the other issue there is the amount. So that if you wanted some, you throw a little bit on a salad or something, and that's not going to be as big of a problem. The other place that people don't think about potassium is milk products. Milk is very high in potassium.
Right.
And so is meat and fish. And so, you know, most foods are
all these good things.
Yeah. You know, typically grains are not that high in potassium.
Yeah, they have like all bran and all the heavily, you know, shredded wheat cereal on the list as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to cook with a lot of whole wheat flour when I bake. Is that still okay?
Oh, I think that'd be fine because it'd be very difficult to get up to the levels that you're going to find in, you know, things again like potatoes or some of these dark greens or a banana, for example, which, you know, a banana's got about 400 milligrams, so they're pretty high too.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for your information.
Thank you.
You're welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to talk with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. Anywhere else, toll 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL. I'm Celeste Quinn. Susan Kundrat is our guest this afternoon. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana would like to talk with you, Susan. On line one, go ahead.
Yeah, quick question. What do you think about soy milk? I was just reading that because of the isoflavones and you get too much estrogen, women shouldn't be drinking even as much as a whole cup of soy milk every day. And I just wondered what you think on that. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, there's a lot of interest and controversy with soy. I always go back to what we know about the early studies with typical Asian diets, and particularly when you think about women and taking in soy and should you or should you not take in soy. And we do know from a lot of studies that soy can be protective if it's in, you know, typical amounts, which may be one serving or two servings a day. And the more, I always say kind of the more natural back to the bean, the better. So if you think about, you know, if you have tempeh or tofu or, again, soy milk, and it's just a cup of soy milk and you had that a day, I think unless your risk is high for estrogen-dependent cancers, you know, if you've got risk of cancer in your family, a breast cancer in your family, or there's prostate cancer in the family for someone and it may be hormone-dependent cancer, then it may be a different story because, you know, then we'd look at other things that you might want to watch too, like flax seeds, which have some natural estrogens as well. But for general overall health, I think that having a serving a day or maybe even two servings a day certainly is not something that we think is going to be problematic. But again, there's a lot of controversy with this, a lot of different studies that are ongoing. What I do tell people is what we know less about, and things like soy supplements and soy shakes, and, you know, when you actually take the soy powder, it seems to be that there might be more risk when you go to more refined sources of soy, but using actual, again, soybeans, you know, something like canned soybeans or dried soybeans and using those, or if you use something in like the tofu or tempeh or miso or those kinds of things, would be more typical use.
To the bean.
Right. It'd be more what we've seen in Asian diets for long periods of time where we haven't seen increased risk. And what we might be more concerned about is people who are supplementing with a lot of additional soy and maybe trying to get 4 and 5 and 6 servings a day or something like that. I mean, then we would be a little more concerned. But a glass of soy milk a day, unless there is some particular risk that you have or you're concerned about from family history, at least personally, I wouldn't be concerned with that. But I think we're going to be finding out, you know, there'll be more and more things coming out all the time. But I think using it in a reasonable amount makes sense to me. It's a healthy, can be a very healthy part of the diet. There are a lot of really good qualities to soybeans and quality protein and other things as well. So I wouldn't say no to soy right now, but at the same time, I'd be reasonable about how much you used.
Okay, very good. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She's a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. No one is waiting on the phone lines at the moment, so if you'd like to join us, I think we can get you right in. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's go back for a moment to high blood pressure and the DASH diet. And so here in this diet, we're looking to boost fiber, boost potassium, moderate on protein, and boost calcium. And then the other thing we're looking to do is really to cut down on the sodium, the salt.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us some tips about what kind of products or what kinds of things are really, you know, where that sodium is hidden, and it can be just by watching it a little in that department, you can make great strides.
Yeah. Well, I think a couple areas that we want to, you know, that we want to look at. One would be eating out, and particularly fast food, because a lot of fast foods are extremely high in sodium. You know, we say, again, for a typical American diet, maybe 1,500 milligrams to 2,300, 2,400 milligrams. That would encompass most of the recommendations that are out there right now. That would be a teaspoon of sodium or a teaspoon of salt, that amount or less per day. And so it's not very much. So if you look on the label of even something like canned soup, for example, which tends to be pretty high in sodium, it may easily be 1,000 milligrams, where we're saying, well, maybe 1,500 milligrams or the 2,300, 2,400 milligrams is about as much as you want in a day. So you could easily, in a cup of soup and a sandwich, have your sodium intake for the day if it was something processed. So the more processed the food is, the more we tend to be concerned about it. Even things, one thing I did bring is in one of my newsletters that just came out recently, Environmental Nutrition, which is a great newsletter, has a lot of really interesting information, updated research in it. It lists nutrition comparisons of a lot of the frozen entrees because, again, you know, but we use a lot of those things. I mean, most people will grab something quick as a frozen meal or frozen entree. And the other day I tried a couple of the new Kashi ones. Their Kashi has some frozen entrees in them. So those are listed as some that, because of the sodium content and low fat, there may be 500 or 600 milligrams as some of their best bets. Healthy Choice has some best bets. Even Stouffer's, some of the Stouffer's Lean Cuisine, that are more like 500 or 600 milligrams of sodium. That's not very much for an actual meal, because you might add a piece of fruit. Again, you add a piece of fruit to that, particularly a high potassium fruit like an orange or a banana, and then that's a very reasonable meal. Maybe you've got a third of your sodium in that meal, but those are even choosing ones that are considered the best
lower
choices.
Yeah.
So those things we have to watch as well, and things like pickles and sauces and ketchup and
salami and
sure, salami.
Olives and...
Right, olives and any of the processed meats and even things like peanut butter. And, you know, there are a lot of things that you can buy low sodium now. And for people who need to watch sodium, I do recommend they choose some things that are low sodium. And even if they need to add a little bit, they just take a teeny pinch of salt and add it in, because that's still going to be a lot less than what you're going to find, for example, in a regular soup. So if you buy a low sodium soup, you can be assured that that's, you know, 135, 140 milligrams or less, which is very reasonable. And then you add in a little bit to there, or add some garlic powder, onion powder, which still adds flavor, but doesn't add the salt.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a vegetarian, but I'm not a vegan. I eat eggs and milk and cheese, but I try to eat those in moderation, especially the eggs and cheese. But I lift weights, and I get a lot of exercise. I'm very active, and I was wondering what's the best source of meeting my protein needs and still keeping it very healthy as far as you know, cholesterol and fat. And, and what's the best way to meet my protein needs on a vegetarian diet like that?
Well, the good news for you is because you're eating some eggs and milk and milk ex, that makes it a lot easier, because we do know things like whey protein, casein protein that are found in milk are quality protein, probably the best protein you can eat in terms of quality protein for exercise and especially for recovery from exercise. So what you would do there is just choose skim products. So if you want to really keep your fat down, you use skim milk, which would be great. So you might increase that amount if you're comfortable doing that, because that's an easy place that you don't get fat per se, but you're getting really great quality protein. You know, just a 20-ounce glass of skim milk is 20 grams of protein. And when you're exercising hard, you know, depending upon what your body weight is, you know, you really want maybe 0.7, 0.8 grams of protein for every pound you weigh in body weight when you're training. And so that can be tricky when you're vegetarian or when you're not eating a lot of animal products. The other thing I would suggest, as long as you eat eggs, is just really bumping up the whites. So, you know, an egg white might have 5 or 6 grams of protein per white. The whole egg is 7 or 8 grams or some protein in the yolk as well. But you could even take one full egg and then add in three or four whites and scramble that up. And so you all of a sudden you have something that's maybe 30 grams of protein, 25 or 30 grams of protein in that scrambled egg mixture. And it's really high quality protein. Egg protein is very high quality as well. And so just by doing maybe those two things, drinking more skim milk, which does not affect the fat but increases protein, and then adding more of the egg white, that's great. And as long as your calorie needs are going to be higher, exercising, you've got room in your diet for more things like nuts and seeds, and maybe add some more beans, which are a good source of protein as well. So you could say, well, if I'm going to add a little more food, maybe I'll go with more nut butters or beans or nuts or sunflower seeds and things like that that are also higher in protein.
Okay.
And doing those things could just gradually bump up your protein little by little. And then I would just be really careful that when you do work out, that right after you work out, you do get something with quality protein as well as carbohydrates. So that might be, you know, we talked a little bit about chocolate and chocolate milk. I mean, you know, that might be something as simple as you have two glasses of, you know, 20 ounces of skim milk and you throw in some Ovaltine or something like that and you have that after for a recovery. That's good timing for the quality protein and you get some extra calories then, which would be great.
Okay, so if you eat a lot of legumes to supplement that, do you have to also add in grains to get the full complement of amino acids?
Well, you only need to have all the amino acids in your day. They don't have to be at the same meal. We used to think they did, but they don't have to be. So for you, for example, because you do have some animal products, you're going to get complete proteins every day. Because you've got those taken care of. So you wouldn't necessarily have to say, well, I'm going to have beans and do I make sure I have rice with it. It's an easy way to complement the protein right at that very time, but you wouldn't have to do that per se because somewhere else in the day you're going to get those other amino acids.
Okay.
So you're fine with that. So if you eat more beans now and have fruit with it and something else, no problem. Maybe later you'll have grains and you'll cover those amino acids. And we know now that if they're, you know, within a day's diet, you're fine in terms of building protein in your body.
Okay. And my last question is, how would skim milk compare with soy milk? If I wanted to choose one or the other in regards to this question, which would you recommend and why?
Well, it's a very good question. I just wrote a whole article about this because it's a question that I get a lot from athletes. And, you know, they're both quality proteins. And I would say if you're going to supplement with additional protein if you need it, I would probably choose whey over soy, partly because you can get that in a powdered form if you need the extra protein, and I don't have any concerns about that. I probably wouldn't supplement with soy if you needed tons of extra protein, but again, a glass of soy milk or two glasses of soy milk in a day, I would say would be fine. I might not drink a lot of extra above that. I might keep it to a few servings a day of the soy, and then over and above that, I would probably have the skim milk. So you've got room. Actually, if you used both proteins in your diet, that'd be great. Because there are certain things you find in soy protein that aren't found in milk or whey protein and vice versa. So if you said in your day you had three or four or five servings of milk and you've got some of each, I think that'd be great because then you get some benefit from different types of foods.
Okay.
Do you use tofu?
I don't.
Okay.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Have a great day.
You too. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. A few minutes ago in your discussion of soy products and estrogen, you mentioned flaxseed. Would you speak to the benefits of flaxseed in general? And then a particular question, would someone with a breast cancer diagnosis, should they avoid that? That's the question. I'm going to hang up and listen.
Yeah, I mean, it does bring up an interesting question because flaxseed, And flax seeds are just these little kind of golden seeds that are grown more in the U.S. all the time, I think, but they're typically grown in Canada. And they're real high in fiber, and they're also real high in fat, and they're high in what would be omega-3 type fat, very not the same as fish fat, but similar to fish fat. And they also do have some estrogen-like properties, just like soy does. And so one of the things that comes up is if someone, again, does have estrogen-dependent cancers, should they take these foods in, or would that maybe cause more problems? Or, you know, and I don't know that we know the answers to all these things specifically, and it's very individual. But I think I think flax would be another thing that you'd want to say, well, I'm not going to go crazy about flax. I'm not going to go overboard. If you use a tablespoon of flaxseed a day, ground flaxseed, and it's not the oil, but it's actually the seeds, that's not probably that much flaxseed that, you know, most people would be concerned about. Again, if you've got a particular cancer that your physician doesn't want to try to have any estrogen-related foods at all, then you'd probably not want to take it in. But maybe a tablespoon a day is not that much, so I wouldn't be concerned about that. But I have had people who have a quarter cup or even more of flaxseed, and then they also take 2 tablespoons of flaxseed oil, and there could be potential at that level to maybe where they're getting, you know, some estrogen-like properties that perhaps could, you know, be a concern. So I think it does get back to that idea that, yes, flax can be a very helpful part of the diet. It's very high in fiber. The one thing I think about flax is every now and then I'll have clients who have problems with constipation, and they've tried maybe everything, and once we get them to gradually add in the ground flax, it seems to be the world's best anti-constipatory agent. You know, it's, among other things, it just, you know, really helps in those ways for some people. So there are a lot of good things about flax, but it's just good to know that it does have some of these estrogenic properties as well as soy, so it wouldn't be something you want to base your diet on.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Are there specific foods that help to reduce cholesterol?
There are specific foods that help to reduce cholesterol, and even kind of getting back to this idea of this DASH diet, it's helpful for cholesterol for most people too, because you end up getting, if you get, you know, 4 or 5 cups of fruits and vegetables a day, you get a lot of soluble fiber that we, you know may decrease cholesterol, among other things, with the blood pressure. So that's one thing. Certainly looking at trying to shift your diet from more processed foods to less processed foods is helpful. So maybe, again, if you're eating cornflakes or Rice Krispies or something like that, and you actually switch to where you're eating oatmeal or these soluble whole grain fibers, or even a cold cereal, you know, like some of the Kashi high fiber cereal or Optimum cereal or some of the oat square cereals, that can be really helpful because you're changing over to where you're getting more soluble or gummy fiber like oat fiber. And other things, even going from regular pasta to whole wheat pasta, that can be helpful. Beans and peas can be helpful with lipids because they have a lot of that gummy fiber. So instead of, again, maybe having something like white rice for your side dish, you're having red beans or beans and rice. That would be better because you tend to have more of the gummy fibers that help lower lipids. And then we look at other things, and just, like I say, just cutting saturated fat, adding some of the higher fat meats, and going more for maybe some more vegetarian options periodically during the week so that you get more fruits and maybe more vegetables and more whole grains. Those things can all be helpful when you're looking at trying to lower cholesterol.
Regards rice and beans and the eating out issue, are the rice and beans that you typically get at a Mexican restaurant with an entree good in that regard, or are they somehow dilapidated?
Well, it may depend on how they're prepared. I mean, usually it's white rice, although a lot of places now you can order brown rice, which is much better, and it's the gummy rice, which is better. And then you might just ask for more beans on the side and ask for them to be made without the fat. Sometimes they're made with lard, which then increases the saturated fat of what you're eating, which kind of does defeat the purpose. It's still helpful having the beans, but you get more saturated fat along with it. So a lot of places, though, will have beans that are cooked without the lard or without the saturated fat, and you can ask for those, and then that would be great. I mean, even something as simple as just chicken fajitas with all the vegetables and then a side of beans, just plain black beans would be super. Usually the black beans are much better than the refried beans. Often the refried beans have more lard added to them or maybe cheese, but the plain black beans are typically better. So that would be a good, certainly a great dish for you.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And if you enjoy eating the Mexican food at home, it's so easy to make your own refried beans using canned beans and mashing them with a little vegetable broth or chicken broth or something like that.
Sure, sure.
And you need no fat in them at all.
Right. You can make those that way yourself, and you can also buy the refried beans that are the vegetarian beans, which typically then don't, of course, have the lard or have the fats added to them too, which are great. And one thing to boost more of the good fat in some beans like that is you could add, especially if you were mixing your own, if you're blending your own, then you could add maybe a quarter of an avocado to that, because avocado adds a fat, but it's monounsaturated fat. So it's, you know, better fat for you cardiovascular-wise. And then that makes it creamy and adds some fat that would be actually really good for you, too, for your heart.
And in place of the sour cream, just a little plain yogurt.
Right. Works super.
Tastes great. That sounds great.
Doesn't that sound good? I'm kind of hungry myself.
Well, I'm wondering, what should we have for dinner tonight?
Maybe, that's right.
Maybe we'll have some fajitas.
Yeah. And sometimes people don't, you know, maybe they've tried a lot of the fat-free things in the past, and if they haven't tasted good to them, something like fat-free sour cream, if it's mixed in something, I think it tastes actually pretty good. Same thing with mayonnaise or Miracle Whip. Sometimes people say, well, I don't eat those things anymore because you have to have mayonnaise. But if you actually mix it in something, you add a little onion or you add some spice, I don't think the flavor is a problem. When you're not, sometimes if you're eating it just by itself, yes, it has a little different flavor and consistency. But if it's mixed in, or you use the yogurt actually works great in all those dishes because it's got that tangy. Very good.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. We have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the program. If you have a question about diet, nutrition, you can give us a call and talk to Susan. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. One more question here before we take another call. Susan's a listener calling in at the moment regarding high blood pressure. You want to talk with us a little bit about caffeine and how it fits into the DASH diet?
Well, it does not fit into the DASH diet. No, I will. No, actually, a little bit of caffeine. I think caffeine is just so individual. So we know caffeine can increase blood pressure. It certainly can. And we also know large amounts of alcohol can increase blood pressure, and some people can affect blood pressure up or down. And so with the DASH diet, the recommendations are to, you know, use caffeine and alcohol very moderately. In other words, if you have a cup of coffee every day and you're used to that and that's sort of your normal plan, that probably isn't a problem. Same thing with maybe you have a drink a day and that's an alcoholic drink. But you don't go too high on either one of those or that can affect you. I certainly, I've had a lot of clients who've been used to a lot of caffeine, and once they gradually bring their caffeine down, I always recommend doing that in steps, not just cold turkey, but gradually working that down to maybe one or two servings a day. For many people, it doesn't really seem to affect their blood pressure negatively. So, and for others, they just feel like they just get used to not having it at all. But caffeine is a stimulant, so it certainly can peak blood pressure, have it go up or down or make you more jittery, and you might notice that feeling as well.
Okay, let's talk with another listener now on line 4 in Danville. Hi.
Good afternoon. I'm asking about taking calcium supplements. I had been taking one extra calcium tablet a day, but lately my doctor recommended to double that. Can I take both of those tablets in the morning, or should they be spaced during the day?
Well, ideally they should be spaced, and it does also depend on how much is in them.
650 or 73 milligrams per...
Yeah, they should definitely be spaced out so that maybe you have one in the morning and one at night.
Okay.
That would be ideal because, you know, if you take them both together, you're still going to absorb, you know, a good amount of them, but it won't be as much as if you separated them.
Yeah, well, I do drink a lot of milk and use cottage cheese and so on, so, but it was a matter of forgetting to take the afternoon one.
Yeah.
My second question is about nuts. I'm getting ready to place an order, what would you recommend? And the question is the variety of nut and whether they should be raw or toasted, roasted.
Well, I think that the more variety you get with nuts, the better, but probably the two that I would look for would be almonds and walnuts.
Which walnuts?
Well, if you have, really, I think the studies on walnuts have been a variety of walnuts. So walnuts in general have more monounsaturated fat. They also have a little more fat that would be considered more omega-3 type fat.
I always have black walnuts on hand, and the question was the ordering I'm sorry, almonds and pecans and macadamias.
Mm-hmm. I would say, again, the first two I'd be almonds and walnuts. Those are probably the best. Pecans may be third. Macadamia nuts are a little higher in saturated fat, but boy, they taste good.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, having those two would be okay. Maybe you don't eat as much of them. I mean, you could certainly order them all. I think having them roasted or raw, both fine. Whatever you like.
Either
better.
One.
Yeah, whatever you like.
All right, then. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
You're very welcome. We have a few minutes remaining, 3 minutes, 4 minutes remaining in this portion of the program. If you've got a question about diet and nutrition, give us a call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, anywhere else outside the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What's the current recommendation for folks generally in terms of calcium and vitamin D?
Well, calcium intake, there's kind of a range of maybe, 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day that generally we should get. But for a lot of people, it's more like 1,500, particularly if they've been low or they haven't had enough or they might be at risk for some problems or have low bone density. Would be more like 1,500. For some people, that's even up to 2,000, depending. But sort of 1,000 milligrams to 1,300 is really kind of takes care of all the age groups. And then with vitamin D, we think about trying to get 400 IUs, but we're seeing tons of research come out on vitamin D. And so a lot of people are saying, well, you probably should double that at least. And so we think maybe the national recommendations are going to be going up at some point. And so even 1,000 IUs of vitamin D would probably be more reasonable, 800 or 1,000.
Yeah. There was an article, I think it was last month, in the New York Times that was reporting on a review published in The Lancet, which is the British, one of the British journals, and they were recommending, especially for older folks, at least 800 IUs of vitamin D.
Yeah, it makes sense because it's being, we know it's related to a lot of things besides bone strength as well.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello there.
I've got a question. What kind of nuts give the best protein?
Well, generally nuts that are a little bit lower in fat or higher in protein. And I'll give an example of something that's not really a nut, but we think of it as a nut, and that's a soy nut. We've talked a bit about soybeans today. And if you like soy nuts, they're quite a bit lower in fat and higher in protein than other nuts. And so that's something that is a really good snack that's a little, again, it's clove bean, it's just soy bean itself that's roasted. So that's one thing to keep in mind in addition to things like, really protein-wise, almonds, walnuts, peanuts, they're all going to be good sources of protein. They're all going to have a considerable amount of fat. If you think about a serving, maybe a serving is about a quarter cup, and that's about an ounce of protein for most nuts.
What about like big nuts like walnuts?
Yeah, walnuts are good sources too. Basically, they have a little carbohydrate and fat and protein. And so if you thought, if you were going to, compare the amount that you would get, let's say a deck of cards of chicken breast is about 20 or 25 grams of protein. And to get that much in nuts, you'd need at least probably a half cup of most of those nuts. So you do get a lot more calories and a lot more fat when you're getting your protein from nuts, but they can add up and become part of a good, portion of your protein intake. But I'd say all those, and even sunflower seeds are good sources and pumpkin seeds are good sources of protein as well, maybe about a quarter cup or a third cup for serving.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Cashews, they're very tasty. They're up there in the calorie department because of the fat, I suppose.
Yeah, they have some protein, too. They're a little bit higher in saturated fat. I think, you use cashews in something like if you have a dish where you have them as just a flavor enhancer. Uh-huh. I always try to smash them and then put them in there so you can actually maybe use your serving is 5 or 6 cashews, so it's not so high in saturated fat, but you can really get great flavor out of them because they taste so good. So they can spread real well and
chop them up and sprinkle a teaspoonful on top of your stir fry. And
right. It's great.
Yeah. And Brazil nuts, are there other nuts that we overlook that could be?
Right. Brazil nuts are also great nuts, and they're real high in vitamin E. I mean, the other thing we didn't talk about was the vitamin E, which is found in fat products and typically very high in nuts. And so that would be another good place to, think about maybe. One thing that one way you could actually get a great benefit from your nuts is to take, maybe you have half of the nuts are almonds and walnuts, and then the others are just a mix of nuts. You know, let's say you got a cup of almonds and walnuts and a cup that's just mixed of all kinds of nuts, and you just mix all that together.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you throw them in little containers or little Ziploc bags, and so you have a mix of nuts, so you're getting maybe some other nutrients, and you're still getting great protein, great fiber. And if you need a little salt on them, I'd buy them unsalted, and I'd just throw a little salt on yourself. And then that way you keep down the sodium, but you might enjoy them a little more if they're a little salted.
Yeah. So it's all in portion size.
Right, right. Okay. If we have time, could I
Yes.
Add one thing I wanted to do? We do have this handout again on the DASH diet that you can get, but I wanted to give the two websites, one that has the great, the probably the most information on the DASH diet, and that's just the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and that's www.nhlbi.nih.gov. And so if you actually search for DASH diet, look for the National Heart, Blood, Lung Institute, because that's where you can actually pull up this great whole program on it where you can get the information. And another place I found some good information, too, was just www.cardioconnection.org.
Okay.
And those were two real good places. There's books on the DASH diet as well, but the National Heart, Blood, Lung Institute does a great job of having free materials.
Okay, and we will have links to these sites on our website at WILL.UIUC.EDU. So you could just put WILL Radio into your browser and get to us,
right.
And then we'll have these up on the web. In the meantime, though, maybe let's just go over them one more time. CardioConnection.org, and then the National
Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute.
Okay. NHLBI.NIH.gov.
That's it.
Okay, very good. And if you'd like the handout that Susan brought with her this afternoon, if you'd like to for us to send you a copy of that, just...